If you like YouTube, you'll love YouTube Premium. Hi, I'm Sean Evans from Hot Ones, and I want to tell you about YouTube Premium. It has offline downloads, so you can watch without Wi-Fi. Background play, so you can lock your phone, and it still plays, baby. Oh, and it is completely ad-free. Yes, I said it, ad-free. Try YouTube Premium for 2 months free at youtube.com/premium. Trial eligibility varies. Terms apply. Cancel anytime.
Labor Day deals are looking good at Lowe's. Save $10 on 1 gallon cans and $50 on 5 gallon pails of select interior paint via rebate. Plus, get two 2.5 quart or 3 quart mums for just $8. A fresh look and savings? Even better. Labor Day deals are on now at Lowe's, in store and online. Valid through 9/9 while supplies last. Mum sizes vary by location and exclude Alaska and Hawaii. See store at Lowe's.com for more details.
Astonishing Legends Network.
The views and opinions expressed by hosts and listeners on the Astonishing Dead Letter Office are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of Astonishing Legends Productions, the Astonishing Legends Network, or any affiliated entities or guests.
When something unexplainable happens to you, it can make you feel isolated or alone. But trust us, you're not. For over a decade, you've been sending your strange stories to Astonishing Legends. And now it's time for our fellow Legenders to hear them too. Join us weekly in Blanket Fortiana as we dig through your intriguing messages to the Astonishing Dead Letter Office.
Tonight's episode, The Lady in the Rocking Chair.
On November 10th, 1969, public television put a new children's show on the air, built by educators and a puppeteer named Jim Henson. And within a couple of seasons, it's teaching letters and numbers to millions of preschoolers, including me. If you were 4 years old in the early 70s, Sesame Street was practically a member of the household, and it was awesome.
It was indeed. I was almost going to turn 4 years old at that time. And I remember sitting down watching it because there was nothing else on like that except for cartoons in the afternoon. So if you remember, folks, cartoons came on early in the morning, you know, before school. You could catch a few.
Yes.
On Saturdays, that was a big day for me because I didn't really watch anything before school. And then in the afternoon, then they would start showing the family-oriented shows like Gilligan's Island and Brady Bunch. And that was after-school stuff and some cartoons thrown in there. But and for a lot of kids, it was the only other kid in the house. Me too, because I was also, like yourself and our author here, an only child. So you have to get inventive to entertain yourself. And I got to say, I was never bored. There's always something to do.
I wasn't either. Being an only child can be a lonely business. And now I have an only child. So, but at least I've been there.
Well, did he watch Sesame Street?
I don't think he did. I feel like now my memories are blurry of him at that age. Yeah, but we were watching a lot of the children's television. God, there was a show he watched, which now I can't remember what it was, but it was not Sesame Street.
It's the big ones. Bluey. But, it's so different now. The shows are so different.
Yeah, I think he was into Bluey for like a few months, something like that. I can't remember. And then graduated to Phineas and Ferb, which we watched religiously. Shout out to Dan Povenmire, by the way, a former guest of our show. Right. Anyway, newsflash, folks, I'm Gen X, and I was what they used to call a latchkey kid, firstly, I was being raised by a single mother in a town with no extended family, and she was working full-time, so I had a key to the house, and when I got home from school, I would let myself in. I'd get a snack, watch a little TV. Did I mention I was an only child? So yeah, latchkey kid.
Well, myself as well, because both my folks worked, and so you get home and I mean, the deal is I was responsible enough to take care of myself. I didn't burn too many things down. And they trusted me.
Yes.
But, you know, also it's part of the socialization. So they had my neighbor lady take me in for the afternoon until my folks got home from work. And so that's what the latchkey kid thing is. So you get home and I could entertain myself, watch TV, make myself a snack. But it was more fun to go next door to where my best friends. And by the way, speaking of weird childhood memories, my childhood best friend at that time, and a few years older than me, who I really looked up to, was kind of my mentor. Apparently, my neighbor said in that house, I just talked to our wonderful neighbor lady next door. She said, yeah, there was a guy that came here looking for you. And he said that ye used to live in this house and you guys would hang out, you know, before your parents got home. I'm like, yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. And I had not seen him since that time. It was just a weird, this connection. So this story coming in tonight has a lot of a ring to it, like a vibe for me that I can totally feel.
Sesame Street plays a very small part in this story, but when she brought it up, a flood of memories came back for me. Back then when we were that age and at this time, I guess, roughly guessing that Moth Maiden is not too far apart from us. You know, you only had seven or eight channels over the air, but one of them was PBS, and Sesame Street was the one I watched for years, even after I aged out of it.
TV was part of it, but certainly no cell phones, no screens really, other than the TV screen. You didn't have computers guiding us or writing our papers for us. So, so everything's transitioning, but people aren't. You were born in that same blank form, and whatever you're exposed to, it's for me anyway, in my thinking, a bit of nature and nurture of how you were raised and what your personality is like, but everybody starts off with the same thing. So it's pared down. You fill in the gaps your brain does or wants to when you don't have that in-person thing. And that's what we're talking about with imaginary friends.
Yes, imaginary friends. I don't think I ever had one, at least that I remember. I could have and might have forgotten at this point, but there's a well-known body of research from the University of Oregon and the University of Washington that says, by age seven, roughly two-thirds of children have had an imaginary companion of some kind. If you count the stuffed animals with full biographies, that's a lot of kids. But pure invisible friends that nobody else can see, that's closer to one in three, apparently.
Two-thirds, you say? That seems like a lot of kids. Not most kids. A lot of kids over the half median. And tonight's listener, whom we'll call Moth Maiden, was one of them. She had an imaginary friend when she was four that seemed pretty well developed.
Yeah, and most of these companions fade out and get forgotten, like mine apparently have if I had one. But what's rare
is you've heard that David Letterman joke, right? He would say sometimes in his monologues, a buddy of his was really sad because his imaginary friend died.
Yeah, right. I've heard that.
Which is funny, but it's like, oh, that's another question, though. Do they go away? Is there an expiration date? Do they pass away? Do they live forever? We'll find out.
That's the interesting thing about Moth Maiden's story. She's remembering a lot of detail here some 40 years later. And that's a memory that researchers would tell you is a little bit of its own puzzle. Earliest childhood memories generally average out to about 3 or 3.5, but some people claim they can recall memories from before age 2. And psychologists have been arguing about that for 100 years now, believe it or not, according to research. So,
and as we all know from our audience, there are kids that remember or have memories from past lives hundreds of years ago.
There you go.
That's a whole other thing. But Moth Maiden here says her memory reaches back that far to when she was very young, two or earlier. And she's a longtime friend of the show. She was at the Idle Hour meetup we had in North Hollywood in 2017, if you remember that, where she took the trivia crown, and her brother still hasn't recovered from losing, apparently.
I cannot believe that was 9 years ago, almost a decade ago.
Yeah. And another friend we met there, who was actually officially working there as a bartender at the time at the Idle Hour, was our good friend Tara Jane from the very successful and popular Natalie and Tara Try Stuff YouTube channel.
Yes.
So go check
her
out.
That's how we got set up there.
Yeah, but she reached out to us, I think, on the old-fashioned Twitter saying like, hey, I work at the Idle Hour. Come by and say hello. And I said, you had me at bartender. So, so we've known her for a long time as well. But like, just imagine where people go, the connections that are made years after that. Well, we've blathered on long enough, as usual. So, Scott, please introduce us to the lady in the rocking chair.
Hi, Scott and Forrest. I'm a longtime listener and even met you both at your Idle Hour podcast meetup back in 2017. My brother still hasn't forgiven me for winning the trivia competition that night as half of the Moth Maiden team, an alliance I formed with a fellow listener I met just moments before the games began. That same brother introduced me to your show the previous year, and I've been a devoted listener and evangelist for your podcast ever since. When you launched the Dead Letter Office, I considered sharing a super spooky story from my childhood. However, I decided it was too long for the segment. Also, it's pretty wild and chilling, so I rarely share it. And tonight, I was listening to the latest episode of the Dead Letter Office entitled, Kids Can Be Creepy, Especially Your Own. And I was reminded of a peculiar, unforgettable experience from my early childhood. I have a very vivid and detailed memory of my life going back to my first and second year on Earth, and this particular memory stands out as a unique instance of note. When I was 4 years old, I had an imaginary friend. At that time, I was an only child, and we had moved into a neighborhood where there were no other young children, and I spent a lot of time with my parents and watching cartoons or playing by myself. Previously, I had friends and more social interaction outside of my family, so it's not surprising that I created a mythical playmate. I don't remember anything specific that she said to me, but I do remember that she looked exactly like Betty Rubble from the Flintstones. Yes, Betty, wife of Barney Rubble, blue dress, black hair, and all. I thought Betty was so pretty, and she was one of my favorite characters, so it's little wonder I modeled my imaginary friend after her. At this time, I was also trying to figure out how cartoons were made, and the introduction of the Muppets made me all the more confused, as I thought cartoons must be people dressed up in costumes. However, I must point out that although she looked like Betty, she was not Betty. Her name was Cindy Cora, last name spelled with a C and sounding like a K. Thank you, PBS and Sesame Street. I know that sounds funny, but the spelling of her name is something that has always been very important to me. I also recall that she was from Mexico. But the strangest specific memory I have about her is one that took place on an especially lovely sunny day in my bedroom. I can still remember the sun coming through the window that faced my backyard. The atmosphere was so soft and buttery. The weight of a hazy veil poured through the window, and it seemed like fairy dust was balancing and floating on the golden rays. The dust seemed to gently challenge the passage of time. Beneath the graceful haze sat an elderly woman seated in a rocking chair. She was slightly plump, not small and frail, and she had a soft and gentle presence. Atop her head was piled a silky mound of white and gray hair. She was neither transparent nor vapor. She was material, yet I wasn't frightened at all. At that time, I, without a doubt, am certain we did not know anyone who looked like this, and I rarely had a babysitter. When I did, she was never someone who looked like this figure. At the time, I had one living grandmother and three living great-grandmothers, and none of them looked like this apparition either. However, I do remember being so drawn to her and how peaceful and warm she seemed. Yet, we did not directly interact. She was just a calm and gentle presence. I experienced no sense of fear, and this is the only time I ever remember such a phenomenon happening. I can also contrast this with a very up-close and personal memory I have with one of my other great-grandmothers when I was 2 years old. The experiences were different, both positive. But with this second experience, there was, well, it was almost as though there was a veil between me and the woman in the rocking chair. Did I mention I had no rocking chair in my room? I confirmed this when, recently, I was reminiscing about the past with my mom. As I retold her the story of Cindy Cora and the elderly woman who I always assumed was Cindy's grandmother, I added that I thought it was significant that the grandmother in my vision or memory did not look like a cartoon character. Despite Cindy Cora looking like an animated figure and watching Looney Tunes, including Tweety Bird and Granny, this was not the grandmother I imagined. She was not cartoonish. She was human. She was real. I told my mom that I had really started to wonder why it was that the woman seemed like a fully human person by contrast with my imaginary friend, who I assigned the appearance of a beloved cartoon character. I confessed that I had begun to wonder if I'd experienced some type of time slip. Maybe I was seeing someone who had lived in the house before. However, my mom began to ask me in detail about the appearance of the woman. She marveled at how this description sounds so similar to her own maternal grandmother. This was especially interesting because my mom's mother was adopted as a young child due to a series of unfortunate events. I'll try to make this as clear and concise as possible. I include this family history because, well, it's relevant. My maternal grandmother was born in 1927, the fifth of six children. She was born to a woman with a tragic story. This woman, my great-grandmother, was injured at birth and paralyzed on one side of her body as a result.
She was sent away to a wealthy family to be raised, but never to be adopted. As a young woman, she married a fireman, and they had 6 children. Then, my great-grandfather, now the fire chief, developed pneumonia while fighting a fire. He soon succumbed to his illness, and my great-grandmother was left handicapped and a newly single parent to 6 young children. The year was 1929. Faced with unspeakable tragedy in a horrible year, my great-grandmother suffered a nervous breakdown and was institutionalized. Who could blame her? All of her 6 children were adopted out to different families. My grandmother was only 2 years old when she lost both her parents and all her siblings. Years later, when my grandmother was an adult and had a family of her own, her biological baby sister found their mother and brought her from the institution so that my grandmother, my mother, and the rest of their families could meet her. My mom has this singular memory of meeting her grandmother, but as we sat there and talked about the person I saw and compared her to the person she met, my mom began to tear up. She said, "I wonder if that was your grandmother, your great-grandmother, who came to see you." I want to add that at the time of this childhood experience, I did not yet know about my mother's meeting with her grandmother or my great-grandmother. So the details about her appearance and presence that coincide were still unknown to me when this memory was first created. Tonight, as I write this, I feel kind of emotional because these memories remind me of what an exceptional early childhood I had. Many do not have such experiences or good fortune. Of that, I am abundantly aware. My grandmother and my great-grandmother alike certainly did not experience such. As a young child, I felt such immense love for my parents, and I also felt a bigger divine love wrapped around me. I always felt protected and cared for, and now as I type this, I can't help but wonder, did I also feel the love of my great-grandmother? I wonder if the woman who my mom described as so quiet and reserved showed up in my room just to take a look at me. Maybe she couldn't bring herself to communicate with me, or maybe that's not allowed. I also wonder if my age played a role in her visit. At the time, I was not much older than my grandmother was when she was taken from her mother. I've also always borne a strong resemblance to my grandmother. Maybe my great-grandmother wanted to peek in for a glimpse of what she missed with her own daughter. I wonder if she's ever peeked in again. My grandmother has now passed, and I pray she's reunited with her mother. And maybe they both look in on me now and again. If they're looking right now, they see me, writing and smiling, tears streaming down my face. Thanks for the opportunity to share this odd yet beautiful experience with you and your listeners. Keep up the great work.
The paranormal surrounds us, and we'll dive back in shortly.
Summer is still here, folks, technically anyway. And if you're a student, summer means a lot of things. No homework, no teachers, no school. It means freedom.
That's right. And as adults, summer can still mean freedom, too, thanks to Mint Mobile's summer sale still going on. Because right now, all of Mint's plans are $15 a month, even unlimited.
Free yourself from big wireless and their gimmicks and gotchas. Mint took what's wrong with wireless, namely astronomical costs, and made it right. All plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text on the nation's largest 5G network.
And the coverage is amazing, and we should know. We've been with Mint nonstop since they first sponsored us nearly a decade ago, which is really hard to believe, but I guess it's true.
I know. I know. We've used them all over the country since then and had great service consistently.
And all of it at a fraction of what big wireless costs. We've upgraded phones since we first joined them, but only because it's been 10 years, and each time we did that, it was a breeze. You can bring your same phone when you sign up, the same number you have now, and rest easy knowing the bill will just stop being something you even think about.
And switching is easy. Just pick a 3, 6, or 12-month plan and say goodbye to a monthly bill.
It really is so easy, especially with eSIM. Anyway, to get your new wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/DLO. That's mintmobile.com/DLO.
Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/DLO. That's it. There's no catch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3 months, $90 for 6 months, or $180 for 12 months. Plan required. $15 per month equivalent. Taxes and fees extra. Initial plan term only. Greater than 50 gigabytes may slow when network is busy. includes up to 20 gigabyte hotspot.
Capable device required. Availability, speed, and coverage varies. See mintmobile.com.
Let's continue our investigation into tonight's dead letter.
Wow, what a wonderful memory from childhood. Just because it wasn't scary as well, it was heartwarming.
Yeah.
In a way, yeah. And what I like about it, introduced one of our listeners and connected us in a way with an interest in these kinds of paranormal things, but in the good way, something comforting and warm and nurturing and caring and a guardian of sorts, or just something checking in that does not come as a black mist out of your Schiffer robe.
Yeah.
One of those stories. But I have questions also. And yeah. One of them, the first going back, we're going to cover all these things because I think they're fascinating in wrapping our heads around what did Moth Maiden actually see? And one of them is, again, I got to go back to the imaginary friend, because as a child, I was interested in that concept, but couldn't really manifest one or didn't want to take the time to, or just wasn't.
Right.
Like I said, I thought about that idea. It's like, oh, how does that work? Is that, should I write this out on paper? Like how do you manufacture? And then I was later, as a young adult, interested in the concept that no, for a lot of kids, they just show up. And then that fascinated me. It's like, what do you mean they just appeared one day? And then what are they? Is it your subconscious? Yeah. Oh, this kid's lonely. You know, kid being me, the subconscious. The conscious part of me is lonely. Let me manufacture a fake friend or an imaginary friend that will keep you company. But it's really all me, the brain, the consciousness, doing all this. And so my first question that I want you to answer, sir, is when... Well, actually, Moth Maiden shouldn't actually answer this, if she could remember. But when you say Betty Rubble, of course, again, we grew up with that, watched a lot of that, wasted many hours when I should have been reading children's books, which I did too. But TV is easy and it's fun. And you see Betty Rubble, I can picture it now, but in her mind, did she see Betty Rubble? Or did she see Betty Rubble as a character in her field of vision outside of her head? Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I feel like it was in her mind. The other thing, there's a lot of really fascinating things about the Betty component, like a lot. Mm. And they only really occurred to me as we were getting ready to get to this part of the show. But well, the first thing is, I don't know if you remember, but in the 80s, being a Betty was a slang for a pretty woman or a pretty girl.
Yeah,
I did look that up. There's some arguments about the origin, but a lot of people connected that to Betty Rubble, to the Flintstones.
Oh, sure.
Other etymologists suggested that it came from pinups from the days of yore, like Betty Page and Betty
I'm going with that.
Yeah, but either way, you know, it was a big slang in Clueless.
Yeah.
Cher, the main character, Alicia Silverstone, goes, oh, she's such a Betty or whatever in that. But there's a lot of interesting things there, but that's not the part that really stuck out to me about the Betty component of this, and whether or not Moth Maiden saw it internally in her mind's eye or externally. Right. That's a fascinating question. But the other thing I thought about, and I don't know why so much stuff comes back to freaking Terry Lovelace, but we had, you know, Devil's Den, The Reckoning, or whatever.
Sure.
We had our series with Terry Lovelace on, who had an abduction incident at Devil's Den State Park in Arkansas, but he also came on our show a second time because he started getting letters from all these people all over the country when his story got out. People saying all this weird stuff happened to me. And that book, which was, I think, Devil's Den, The Reckoning, that had a story in it. That's where he talked about his version of Betty. And it was he named her Betty. Didn't he name her Betty because she resembled Betty Rubble to him?
That I have to find the details of. But I do remember that this is what I do remember from reading it, is that, you know, an attractive woman, but with Asian type features and a wig, kind of like the...
who's
it from The Incredibles, the costume maker, Edna.
Oh, Edna Mode. Yes, who is based on the famous costume designer, Edith Head.
Edith Head, yes.
Away, but, yes.
I don't know why, but talking about cartoony type characters, I pictured her with the China doll haircut, right? That kind of... And so Terry talks about this woman that would, not as a child, but come to visit him and discuss with him, who he later believed, or I think she may even said this, was an alien human hybrid.
Right.
Who could kind of read his thoughts, or at least was very empathetic and know his feelings, in that she felt him sensing that her wig was not on right, that her appearance was a little cockeyed. And so she got a little embarrassed by that. from what I remember, but
yeah,
I think he did call her Betty, but yeah, she had somewhat Asian features.
I was just looking at our transcripts of our interviews with Terry, and he did say, quote, she reminded me of Betty Rubble.
Yes, exactly. Right. So that kind of hair,
especially in profile, apparently.
Yeah, the hair. Right. So there's a connection there. The other one, when you're talking about Sesame Street, we talk about a lot. And this may come from the second volume of Terry's books, The Reckoning, Devil's Done the Reckoning, or David Weatherly's Strange Intruders, where somebody reports seeing an Elmo-like figure in a field.
Yes.
And then seeing a few more. And at first it's fun. It's like, wow, that's weird. What is that? And then there's a few more.
Yeah.
And then there's many more. And then it's not so much fun. Then it's
like
terrifying.
The miners in Galaxy Quest.
Yeah.
Yes.
Like, right.
Miners, not miners. Yes.
Right.
Yes.
They're not cute and cuddly.
Here's the thing I'm wondering, Forrest. I'm wondering, and I'm smiling as I say this. You listeners might be able to tell, but I'm not making a joke here. I'm wondering if we're uncovering a thing. If there's a thing with people seeing some version of Betty Rubble, especially kids, but also people, and it's somehow connected to like a haunting mind vision or an abduction experience or visitation or something. Because why does this keep coming? This isn't the first time it's come up. Now, there's been different versions of it. And Terry himself speculated, I believe, when we talked to him about this, that these things are trying to present themselves in non-threatening ways to children.
Yeah. Okay.
So they can interact with them and then the kids won't be scared. But it's curious to me that this specific Betty thing comes up. And I also feel like there was another story with like a brunette sort of Asian looking woman, a dead letter or something, like driving a car or walking down the street, like mysterious sort of, there's something. I wonder if this is a black eyed kid that hasn't emerged yet.
Well,
you know, from the paranormal zeitgeist.
You mean an archetype?
Thank you.
Well, there's a couple things. One is our very good friend, Veronica, had told me before about she had an imaginary friend as a very young child, which through talking about with her mother, I believe, and I don't want to screw up the story, but
they
believe may have been a deceased child within their family that came to visit her and became an imaginary friend. So that's one possibility of this, in that it's a spirit. It is a form of spirit or from the past. Another one, now you just reminded me of the comforting image of something taking place and able to impart empathically feelings. I think about Contact, where Jodie Foster goes through the wormhole, the Rosenbridge, Einstein-Rosenbridge, and ends up in another more so solid planet, but with a higher NHI, non-human intelligence, who can control thoughts and things. And it's benevolent, thank goodness.
Yes,
but
and appears as her, a doctor from the TV show ER.
You might have met David Morse?
Yeah, he was in ER. He was one of the doctors.
Oh, that's from way back. Yeah, but he's very tall and a very gifted actor, but very pleasing to her because it's her deceased father who she misses terribly, but who also got her interested in astrophysics and outer space. And but appears like that because it's something she can identify with, and she feels she has those feelings, but she knows it's not her father, because the entity tells her it's not, but has chosen that appearance, but also it imparts all those feelings. And probably the scary part of that is that it's like the three-body problem. Like, our appearance to you would not be pleasing.
Yeah.
Or, you know, there's something that you may
not
want to see.
Same thing in that old Star
them.
Trek, where they're like actually little like slugs. And then
it's maybe something it's maybe something you're not going to be pleased with or disturbed by. So for right now, this is it. And you may not understand. And I know that's philosophically hard to wrap your head around. You may not understand what their true form is or looks like.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? So your brain just like, well, that's what we're going to go with. It's Betty Rubble. So that's.
Yeah.
So in that character, though, also what you mentioned in sort of the same way is that kind of archetypical character. So you have Betty also, you know, the kids, at least now everything's old. So at least 5 or 10 years ago, the kids were calling a very attractive young woman a baddie in school. So she went from Betty to baddie, and now
that's
something
still
different.
Out there. Yeah,
is
that's
it?
Still floating.
Oh, good to know that I haven't aged completely out of
That's
right. It's changing so fast, but you have the idea of this kind of an avatar of sorts for something else. And so in the David Weatherly case, you have these icons. Same thing with the monkeys coming out of Terry Lovelace's, you know, into his bedroom. It's like, these are fun and frivolous and come with us. And he's like, you're not really playful monkeys. Also, monkeys don't do that. Right. Also, I could tell you're wearing some kind of a mask.
Yeah.
And they get upset with him because it's not working. And then in communion with Christopher Walken, there's a scene where he wants them to, like, you know, why don't you show me your real face? And the alien starts to peel it off, and there's something kind of alien and horrible underneath it. And he's not buying it. He's like, nah. He goes, but very clever of you. Very, you know, just don't show me it. I got it. I know why you're not doing that. Because it may not be something physical in that sense. And there's some mystery to it, but like, oh, do you want to see us as a weird alien? Okay, we can do that. It's not pleasant. And pretends or starts to peel that face away. And then he just knows, like, no, that's not it. You're still hiding.
Yeah.
And he goes, very clever. Yeah. But anyway, there's something there where you're not really seeing what's there. And again, I wonder, like you said, is that in the mind where you're seeing Betty Rubble? And that's the closest thing a child's brain is going to go to. But the other thing that reminded me of that, what that looks like, and especially because somehow she knew she was from Mexico. Okay. Now, is that child that young aware of Mexico as a country or a place? Because then she reminds me of not Cora, but Dora the Explorer.
Yeah. Yeah. Because
Dora looks like that a little bit. But that's just way before her time.
Maybe she was looking into the future.
I know that sounds crazy, and this all sounds way out there, but maybe there is something about that, where a child that has that prescience at that age is able to visit in their mind and gather other information from different places and different times in the all connected space-time fabric. So where's this happening, and where are things injecting it? And is the grandmother really a spirit? So this is where I'm getting. Remember I said, it could be an imaginary friend. We certainly heard lots of those stories, and that seems to make more sense to us if you're willing to believe in ghosts and spirits and that we never really die, N-E-R-D, no one ever really dies, that we can come back to loved ones and appear. And then the other thing that she kind of mentions in the story is that maybe there's a reason that she didn't stay too long, but she had a moment. And what do we hear so often from spirits, apparently, that appear to loved ones? It's like, I can't stay long, or I'm only allowed this time, or I'm going to have to go back to where I came from. And she wonders, is that part of the rules? Well, yeah, there does seem to be some limitation on that. Same thing in the motion picture 2010, The Year We Make Contact, is that some image of Dave Bowman comes back and is there to deliver a message. And what he says is, I don't have a lot of time. I'm only allowed to deliver this message. So there are rules about things going on, and maybe the same thing for this image. It was just the right moment where the sun is coming through, and it's a little bit, maybe, like she said, like a time slip or a dimensional slip or a state of being slip, and she's shown this image. So maybe it is the great-grandmother. And again, as people know who have studied their history, like when she passed, like, yeah, that was a bad time. That was the start of the Great Depression, kicking off in October of 1929 with a stock market crash and going for 10 years, ending shortly around 1939. And if you think things are bad now because your Wi-Fi on the plane sucks, imagine back then with whole families living in burnt out cars and just going to soup lines. And we got through it. I think that's the message there, the takeaway. But that kind of trauma also branding and imprinting her with the poor woman that had to be institutionalized, being allowed to come back to look at something joyful.
I actually had to, I tried to draw out a family tree because I was trying to keep track of everything she was saying with all these people. It's interesting that, like, her great-grandmother had all these kids, but then they're adopted out. Also, by the way, Moth Maiden, my great-grandfather was a fire chief too.
That's so right. I noticed that. Yeah.
But the other thing that's interesting to me about this is, you know, the difference for her. She's carefully categorized these two things that she experienced both of, and the woman in the chair, and in this case, Betty or Cindy Cora.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this idea that she's already wrapping her head around the differences in these apparitions, but she's experiencing both of them and keeping them in different categories. And The other thing that's interesting from a time slip orientation or like the observation is the idea, and this is always interesting to me, because we talk about apparitions being dressed in period garb or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And they might have a prop or two, but this one fully had a rocking chair that she brought with her. The chair was not in the room when she wasn't there, which I thought was pretty interesting. Yeah. It's like, you know, you're bringing your own furniture. I think that's some kind of power there if you can do that.
Right. What are the mechanics of all this? Is there something... Yeah. Is it just an image, or is that's kind of my questioning here philosophically, is that are you seeing something projected out in front of your eyes, or is it in your right. head being manifested? And then you don't really need to bring a rocking chair. You just need to manipulate that aspect of electromagnetic consciousness and brain waves, and that's what appears. Or is it something teleported in a way to be in that room through the beam of light?
She wrote that section. Yeah, I did like that. And here's another interesting thing that I think is a question for Moth Maiden, honestly, is there's a possibility when you look at the timeline of all this that her great-grandmother may have been alive during when she saw this vision.
Yeah.
So that's a question I have. Was this possibly a vision of a living person who she was not aware of at that time? Or had she already passed? So that would be a big question for me. Maybe we'll hear back from her on that.
Just quickly as a side note, sorry. Speaking of our good old friend, Veronica also told me that not too long ago, she was seeing possibly an apparition of a smaller Asian woman outside in her hallway of her place like an apartment building. Yeah, showing up.
What is going on?
I don't know, but... Listen, as somebody who has a small Asian woman for a mother, it's just she's not getting around.
You saw that too today. It was there's nothing no
I
deal.
Did, but she was alive and well. The thing is that it's just a weird avatar of sorts or archetype of something. And for our friend Veronica, if she still listens, no fault to her at all if she doesn't. But what is that? Because she doesn't know any. You know, there's nothing. There's no reference or context there, and she didn't really get what she wanted. She seemed friendly, but also I think she outlines something. Okay, I know you don't mean me any harm, and you may want to tell me something, but it's freaking me out a little, so please don't do that anymore. And then after that, she never showed up again. So that could be more spirit.
That comes back to the whole permission structure, all of that stuff, which I think is interesting. We talked with Chris McKinnell a little bit about that, the Warren's grandson.
Yeah.
But the whole idea of the permission and what you give it a right to do and how it participates in your life in the moment and moving forward.
Well, as far as appearing to somebody, and again, if there's maybe there's implicit permission and being this person's great-grandmother, this child, is that they'll show up or they're just already there, so they don't really need permission to enter your sacred space or your safe space. They're there. Also, Moth Maiden, you know, was entertaining this childhood Betty Rubble friend. But again, I don't know, is that just purely an imaginary friend? Purely sewn out of the imagination of a child? And again, some things like the name, that's a somewhat sophisticated Cindy Cora from Mexico. that's probably a real person.
Specific.
But how would a three-year-old come up with that? It's like, Cindy and other names you've heard from other people. But again, would a preschooler come up with a name they've never heard of? Like, oh, this is Gertrude. Sounds kind of old-fashioned. unless it's kind of hipsters, but I do remember... some friends I'd met, and I love this bit. They named her little daughter Doris. And it's like, that's not a name you hear very often, but for hipster musician types, that's cool. I approve of that. Making that connection between other generations. But how does a child do that? And where is that coming from? And even picturing something like that, like a softly lit and warmly felt great-grandmother presence who didn't interact with her as an interaction might happen with an imaginary friend. I mean, who's going to have an imaginary friend that doesn't really talk to you? You know, I think some have.
Yeah.
I have heard of small children who he doesn't say anything, but he's always around and he's just there when I play and he keeps me company, although we don't really talk. So that is right. a variation of that. But I do wonder if it's just purely imagination, why would you make that up? Unless you would, I'd like having you here, but I really don't have time to for our small talk. So you just hang out there to the side while I'll play. And I like the company, but really I'm not into having a conversation. It seems a little advanced. I think when you would have an imaginary friend, you would want to converse with them. And so that's interesting. And then, of course, you have the more advanced version, like the Sixth Sense. So here, though, like there's so many fascinating things going on. And as she said, she makes a division between the two. But yeah. do you think there is a division, Scott? Do you think that this is part of the same phenomenon? Is there any connection that you can feel?
Honestly, I'm aligned with her. I feel like she's having two separate experiences here. And I think they're in different categories because that's where they want to be. And I think they're both very specific.
Yeah.
However, I will say, okay, well, the imaginary friend, the details there are intense. But like when we talk about things, if you believe any of this at all, when we talk about things like you've already alluded to, past life regressions or these ideas of memories from another lifetime, from before you were born, all of those things, theoretically, again, if you believe in that stuff, are very fresh when you're young. So maybe it was more than imaginary friend. Maybe it was some kind of latent memory that was left over from a prior life or something like that. But it also could be, hey, it's a little kid and they want somebody to hang out with or whatever. And I mean, the bottom line is this. You can get into really detailed narratives about your imaginary friends and things like that. And I say this as someone who, and it's a different vein, but I remember dumping a big box of Legos on the floor. Yeah. And my Legos, folks, this was before every Lego was some branded thing from a movie. This was just a bunch of squares and rectangles and like flat pieces. You had to make your own thing with it.
Right.
And I remember like dumping it all out on the floor and assembling something. Oftentimes it would be inspired by the Sandcrawler from the first Star Wars movie. Something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
But I had like, while you're sitting there, especially if you're alone, but sometimes I'd have a friend over and we'd both be doing, you develop this whole elaborate storyline.
Right.
You got little characters and, oh, we're stranded on this planet. And you start writing a movie while you're playing.
Yeah.
That's part of normal play. And it's feasible that you could come up with a detailed imaginary friend that has all kinds of specific features that you like or you're interested in.
Yeah.
So that one can kind of go in either lane, but then there's, and I would say that it could be paranormal and amazing in that way, or it might be completely unrelated. On the other hand, the ghost, the woman in the chair, is very specific. The tie back with the family that connects her to a living person.
Right.
It's very interesting. This is also a thing that is a folkloric. It has a vein that runs through many cultures and generational history around the world. People say, oh, I saw so-and-so. And it's like, oh, you saw your great, great, great uncle who died in battle at, you know, XYZ 200 years ago. But here's a picture. And it's like, oh, yeah, that is him.
Yeah.
You know, so there's some of that happens too. But the stories always feel real to me. And I think that's what's really cool about this letter. So I guess one of the big questions for me is, was her great grandmother still alive when she saw the woman in the rocking chair?
Right.
And we've heard stories like that of people appearing a lot of times just before death or if death is imminent. But people are alive. We have heard stories too over the years of people who were alive and well and still appearing in some sort of apparitional form, but it's less common, at least in our experience.
I have a friend who did see that. And what's interesting is that there's some bilocation involved too, where a very good friend of mine, her father was terminally ill, but a few weeks before he died, at least 2 weeks, he appeared to her. She was waking up. Saw him sitting on her hamper, like across the bedroom. And it was just that moment of like, what are you doing here? Because he looked so real, but looking straight ahead.
Right.
Not acknowledging her like this, not interacting. Same thing with the grandmother here in the chair. Abuela is just sitting, you know, staring straight ahead. And then it's one of those things where I can't remember if she said he faded away from her vision while she was looking at him, or she turned her head, looked back, and he was gone. And then right after that, she called her sister, and she also comes from a larger family, and called she's closest psychically with an older sister who is also part of another set of twins, and called her up and said, you're not going to believe this. And she goes, you saw Dad? She goes, yeah. How do you know? She goes, because he appeared to me too. At the same time, he appeared to two daughters who were more psychically open to that stuff. And this is before he died. And the same thing. He was just, I can't remember, he with the older sister, if he was just sitting in the living room or standing, but didn't interact, was just appeared. And then about 2 weeks later, he passed. But it's a way of them saying goodbye one last time.
Yeah.
And it's a crisis apparition that happens before someone dies. Same thing with Toni Collette in About a Boy. That's one of my other favorite scenes, is that it's before she has an actual crisis with her health. She appears, which alerts the boy and Hugh Grant to go home and check on her. Like, something's wrong. So they run home. Nicholas Holt is the boy. And so what I love about those is that same thing. It's not explained. It's just something that happens and is seen, but is pretty startling, you know, to both the character and the real people who see it. Comforting in a way, but also it's like, this is so weird and unusual. Whereas a child here just takes it for granted. Like, well, that was interesting. Like, you don't question it. You know what you saw. But is that being, where is that coming from is the big question I have. And how is that working? How are the mechanics of that? And I don't think we'll ever maybe find out. Even after you pass, you may not know. You might be just participating in it. And like, I don't know why I'm here or how I got here, but I'm here.
Well, this dead letter comes down to the order that things happened in. She described the woman first: plump, gentle, gray, white hair piled high, solid enough to touch. And only afterward did her mom bring out that one afternoon decades earlier when she'd met her own grandmother. The description existed before the family history that explains it. That's what makes it an amazing dead letter. Now, two memories that old can drift toward each other over 40, 50 years. A woman who lost 6 children in a single terrible year, getting one long, quiet look at a great-granddaughter with her daughter's face, if that's what happened, we understand why she didn't speak. Unexplained, and we're content to leave it that way for now, as Forrest just said. Moth Maiden, thank you for trusting your story to the Astonishing Dead Letter Office.
The Astonishing Dead Letter Office is hosted by Scott Philbrick and Forrest Burgess and is executive produced by Tess Feifel. The show is edited and mixed by Sarah Voorhees-Wendell at VW Sound. The theme is based on the Astonishing Legends theme by Judson Crane at Founder Music, arranged by Alan Caricia, who composes all the other music in the show. Tommy Beaver Design created the logo. The announcer is John Bowler. That's me. Stories are lightly edited for length, content, and readability, but otherwise presented as they're sent to us. We're always looking for more dead letters, so if you have a story of your own you'd like to share, email it to deadletteroffice@astonishinglegends.com. Please include how you would like to be credited. First name only, first name last initial, anonymous, a pseudonym. Let us know. Due to the number of emails coming in, we often cannot respond, but we do read them all. No part of the show may be reproduced anywhere without permission. Copyright Astonishing Legends Productions.
If you like YouTube, you'll love YouTube Premium. It's destroying athlete, creator, and YouTube maxer. YouTube Premium enhances how I use YouTube with awesome features like offline downloads, so I can download my favorite training videos before I hit the gym. So no Wi-Fi doesn't turn leg day into loading day. Plus, I get ad-free videos, background play, and so much more. YouTube Premium is like YouTube got some extra gains. Try YouTube Premium for 2 months free at youtube.com/premium.
Hey, what's up, guys? It's Haley Bailey. Okay, I need to tell you about something. I just got YouTube Premium. It's got tons of awesome features like offline downloads, so I can download my favorite videos before I travel and watch them whenever I don't have Wi-Fi. Because we all know airplane Wi-Fi is the worst. I get ad-free, I get background play, and there's like a ton more in there. You should try it. If you like YouTube, you'll love YouTube Premium. So try YouTube Premium for 2 months free at youtube.com/premium. Trial eligibility varies. Terms apply. Cancel anytime. That's a mouthful.
Hey guys, it's Ashley Canetti from the Ben and Ashley I Almost Famous podcast. You know, I'm always looking for simple ways to make better choices, especially when it comes to food. Lately, I've been using Wise Code, the ultra processed food detector. It's become one of my favorite apps. All you have to do is scan a product and it instantly tells you if it's ultra processed. If I want to dig a little deeper, I can also see the nutrition quality and overall health quality before I buy it. It makes grocery shopping so much easier. I've got little kids, they're picky eaters, but it really allows me to find brands that are going to taste good for them, but also make their bodies happy. You can download Wise Code on the App Store and give it a try today.
Ever thought about Botox but worry you'll look, well, overdone? You're not alone. That's exactly why so many people choose Caps. Their approach is all about keeping your expression natural because Botox shouldn't freeze your face. It should refresh it. At Caps, treatments are performed by licensed nurses known for precise and subtle refined enhancements, all overseen by nationally ranked plastic surgeons. Now's the perfect time to start Botox. Book your first appointment and receive a $50 Caps MedSpa gift card. Schedule today at experiencecaps.com. Caps, where confidence begins.
From athletic stuff like a full court pickup game, swish, to athletic-ish stuff like a half mile stroll. Get those steps in. Head to Sierra or Sierra.com for the brands you want at the prices that let you do it all. From athletic to athletic-ish, Sierra's got it.
Bite into a stacked sandwich made with Hero Bread or a fully loaded bagel. And the only thing you'll think is delicious. You won't think it's up to 19 grams of protein, but it is. You wouldn't believe it has 11 to 32 grams of fiber, but it does. Hero Bread makes loaves, buns, tortillas, bagels, and noodles packed with taste, but without all the net carbs. We're talking 0 to 5 grams net carbs per serving. With Hero Bread, there are no compromises, just flavor. There's none of the stiff baked goods you'd expect from better-for-you brands. There's just the soft, fluffy bread you crave. Plus, small batch drops of indulgent favorites, like the popular 2-gram net carb Hero Croissant and 3-gram net carb Hero Pain au Chocolat. And right now, Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code IHEART at checkout. That's code IHEART at hero.co. All figures per serving of Hero Bread. See nutrition facts on hero.co.
Until now, the data your AI depends on has been trapped behind ever-increasing cloud fees. Wasabi created Hut Cloud Storage and is redefining cloud storage for the AI era, delivering simple, predictable cloud storage for AI, analytics, media, and more. Your data is free to move, fast to access, and ready when your AI needs it. Hidden fees add up fast as AI workloads grow. Wasabi's flat pricing eliminates all of it. One rate, no surprises. Learn more and try now for free at wasabi.com. Wasabi, the AI storage cloud. Proud partner of the iHeart Podcast Network.
Hey guys, it's Ashley Canetti from the Ben and Ashley I Almost Famous podcast. You know, I'm always looking for simple ways to make better choices, especially when it comes to food. Lately, I've been using Wise Code, the ultra processed food detector. It's become one of my favorite apps. All you have to do is scan a product and it instantly tells you if it's ultra processed. If I want to dig a little deeper, I can also see the nutrition quality and overall health quality before I buy it. It makes grocery shopping so much easier. I've got little kids. They're picky eaters, but it really allows me to find brands that are going to taste good for them, but also make their bodies happy. You can download Wise Code on the App Store and give it a try today.
When it comes to plastic surgery, expertise matters, and CAPS sets the standard. Our team includes 7 nationally ranked, board-certified plastic surgeons. From tummy tucks, breast augmentation, and liposuction to facelifts and beyond, every surgical plan is tailored to your body, goals, and recovery timeline. CAPS is trusted for consistent, visible outcomes. Plus, when you book your surgical consultation, you'll receive a $100 CAPS MedSpa gift card. Expert care, exceptional results. Visit experiencecaps.com. CAPS, where confidence begins.